This meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. on Friday, January 23rd, 2026. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Jude Augustine from the Juno LAO, who makes sure we have sound. I think Jude is new to our adventures. Welcome. This time I will remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have first, welcome to the committee, Senator Tilton.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens, my vice chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only item on our agenda today is Senate Bill 136, Firearm Financial Privacy, sponsored by Senator Cronk. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill, and I would note that Senator Tobin has also joined us at 1:31. Here to present the bill is Senator Cronk and his staff, Paul Menke. Online and available for questions is Tracy Reno from the Division of Banking and Securities. Senator Cronk, Mr. Menke, please come forward. Put yourselves on the record. You may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We're thankful for having a hearing this year, you know, and just being able to hear the bill. Senate Bill 136 is the title, is an act relating to the privacy of firearm transactions relating to discrimination against firearm retailers by financial institutions and payment networks relating to the disclosure of financial records by financial institutions and payment networks. Over the past decade, there have been instances in lower 48 and even in Alaska, and there's actually a letter attached that shows in Alaska, where certain financial institutions and states have looked to require firearm codes to identify merchants, buyers, in all transactions involving firearms. These financial institutions and payment networks have used the presence of these codes to throttle and in some cases outright decline lawful transactions involving firearms, which is discriminatory and blatant infringement of our right to keep and bear arms. The right to keep and bear arms is highly valued by the people of Alaska. In 1994, that year, Governor Tony Knowles was elected. Almost three quarters of all Alaskans voted in favor of ballot measure one, which clarified and strengthened the individual rights to keep and bear arms. Article 1, Section 19 of the Alaska State Constitution states a well-regulated militia being necessary to security of a free state, the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This individual right in keep and bear arms should not be denied or infringed by the state or political subdivisions of the state. SB 136 would bolster Alaska's rights to privacy and keep and bear arms by enacting statutory provisions to prevent financial institutions and payment card networks from discriminating against law-abiding citizens and retailers from engaging in lawful commerce and their exercise their Second Amendment rights. And with that, I have my staff, Paul Menke, that can go over the sectional analysis.
And any questions for Senator Cronk before we get the sectional analysis? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with the bill. It makes a lot of sense. But I think it's good to get on the record. What are those instances in Alaska where folks have been denied either the use of a credit card or the banks have worked against them having their privacy rights?
There is, and I hope the committee has it, there is an email dated looks like January 2026 from Donna Anthony, and she goes into great explanation of her business and how it affected her business. And this some of this transaction stuff might not affect places like Sportsman's Warehouse, but it's really detrimental to small businesses where they're putting like for her, she used an example of a $10,000 charge that was denied, you know, so that really affects small business. So, I mean, if you have time, I would go over it, but I think you guys may all have a copy of that email, so you could look at that.
I appreciate that, but I just think for the public record, so folks know what we're talking about here, it might be good to specify those instances if you can.
Okay. thank you, Chair Klayman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Paul Menke, and I'm staff to Senator Mike Cronk. Through the chair to Senator Stevens, so the letter that is detailed, this is just one instance, and I will just highlight it really quick. So in this instance, a woman by the name of Donna Anthony, who's a small business owner in Alaska, had conducted some training and some firearms training up on the North Slope in Alaska. And because of the presence of the firearm code in that transaction, She had been declined. Tried to make a transaction for $10,000 to go towards her business, but that was declined. And she tried to work through that with the payment card network. And according to her, the payment card network did not really give her a straight answer of the reason of why she was declined, but she suspected that it was due to the presence of a firearm code. And she had worked with Senator Sullivan at the federal level to get this remediated. And after what I believe is quite a bit of time, she, with the help of Senator Sullivan's office, was able to get this resolved, and the $10,000 charge was credited to her account.
Thank you. I appreciate you putting that on the record.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, Paul Mankey, to the committee, if I may go through the sectional analysis.
Please.
Okay. So Section 1 amends AS06.90 to add a new section, AS06.90.20, that would prevent financial institutions and payment networks from discriminating against firearm retailers or customers by declining lawful card transactions based on the merchant's status as a firearm retailer, limiting or declining to do business with a customer, potential customer, or merchant for lawful firearm transactions, charging higher transactions or interchange fees for lawful firearm transactions, taking an action against customers or merchants with the intention to impede engagement in lawful transactions involving firearms, involving a firearm accessory or component or ammunition. It establishes statutory provisions that prevent the disclosure of financial records collected in violation of this section. Give the Attorney General the ability to investigate alleged violations of AS44.99.515, created in Section 2 of this bill, and upon finding a violation, obligate the Attorney General to provide written notice to the violator. States that the Attorney General may file an action to enjoin continued violations of AS44.99.515 after 30 days, establishes a maximum fine of $10,000 for knowingly violating AS44.99.515, and legally obligates the court to award the Attorney General or petitioner full reasonable attorney fees and any other remedy the court deems appropriate if their action prevails. And it also provides several definitions in AS06.90.020 for ammunition, department, disclose, financial institution, financial record, firearm code, firearm retailer, knowingly, payment card, and payment network. Section 2 amends AS44.99 by adding a new section, AS44.99.515, to prohibit, with the exception of records kept during a criminal investigation or as otherwise required by law, a person, the state, or a political subdivision of the state from knowingly keeping or causing to be kept a list, record, or registry of privately owned firearms or owners of privately owned firearms. And just a quick note that this does not apply to private citizens who would wish to keep a list of their own personal firearms. And then Section 3 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding two indirect court rule amendments that change Rule 65 and Rule 82 of the Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure. And Section 4 establishes a conditional effect for AS06.90.020G and AS06.90.020I enacted in Section 1, requiring a two-thirds vote of each body for Sections 3A and 3B to take effect.
Questions? Senator Tobin, I think.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome to our first hearing of Senate Judiciary for the year. Thank you for bringing this legislation. I have a few questions that I know that my office has also reached out to you on, and then a few others about just ensuring that we are making we are providing for the public safety on this legislation. So I know one that we had talked about a little bit is about domestic violence shelters, and I know that you're working on an amendment regarding to that. We know that there are many folks who are very concerned about folks who've been accused or even adjudicated of domestic violence, and those shelters may keep a list to protect the clients that they are serving. Can you talk a little bit about the amendment that you're working on to kind of close that particular public safety loophole?
Yes, for the record, Paul Mankey, through the chair to Senator Tobin. So, and we are happy to continue working with your office if this is not a satisfactory remedy to you. But after reaching out to Ledge Legal, there was some concern that it would prevent those domestic violence shelters from creating a list. So the work order that we put in would it would remove the or a person from the records, and it would just apply it to financial institutions and payment card networks, just to limit it to the state, political subdivision of the state, and financial institutions and payment card networks.
Follow-up?
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you. And my follow-up to that is, and I'm thinking about an instance that has happened at my own old high school, where a young student knowingly brought a firearm onto campus. And there has been some concern about the school keeping any list of a student who might have potentially violated the no firearms on school grounds. And if that student transferred schools, how would they provide that information to another district? So the concern I have is also under that political subdivision, as our schools are part of our political subdivision. So that's just another concern I have around public safety.
Okay, for the record, Paul Menke, through the chair to Senator Tobin. Thank you for that question. If I may direct the committee's attention to page 4, line 13. So it says, except for records kept during the regular course of a criminal investigation and prosecution, or as otherwise required by law. So I believe that might cover that concern of if there was a student that had brought in a firearm or had violated any type of law, whether it be no firearms in schools or another thing, that political subdivision, being the school or being a police department or even the financial institution, would be able to keep and provide those records to law enforcement for investigation.
Thank you. I just want to ensure we got that on the public record.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Menke, not having a copy of that amendment you described in front of me, the question that I had come up with would be whether the bill as written, or perhaps the amendment fixes it, would prevent a financial institution from offering benefits or incentives. So I was looking at getting a Brownells credit card because I reload a lot. I don't particularly want a piece of legislation here that's going to stop Brownells from giving me points when I buy 8-pound kegs of powder. Does the bill with that amendment fix that problem?
For the record, Paul Menke, through the chair to Vice Chair Keel. I'm uncertain if the bill would necessarily impede that obligation. From our office had a meeting with Scott Talbot, representing the Electronic Transaction Association, and they are still, as far as the payment company or payment networks are concerned, what they collect is they'll collect the transaction ID, and then it'll have an amount. So if they had points per se, if you were to buy firearm parts or ammunition, then you'd still be able to get those. I don't believe that those companies collect exactly like an itemized list of what was purchased. I apologize,
Senator Keel.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with my Alaska Airlines visa that a lot of people have, when I log on, I can choose. They have contracts with vendors of various kinds, and they want me to opt into the Papa John's pizza discount every time I buy a pizza from their particular Papa John's, because I'm sure they have a financial arrangement. So they definitely have more information than just what kind of company it is, because they don't give me a discount at Domino's. So the question is, with your definition of disclose covering any purpose other than to process or facilitate a payment card transaction, it sounds like it's going to get in the way of my Sportsman's Warehouse account. Am I missing something?
For the record, Paul Menke, through the chair to Vice Chair Keel, I am unsure of that answer, and we can, if it would be okay, we can get back to the committee with a response on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a little bit similar to Senator Keel's question, I'm looking on page 3, lines 18 through 20, around the definition of financial institution. And I'm curious, because I don't know if this falls underneath that particular Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, about insurance companies or potentially your estate plan and your lawyer facilities. My husband has some very expensive firearms that he has bought recently, much to the chagrin of our bank account. And we want to ensure that those are willed and gifted to our dependents and to our beneficiaries. And so those institutions, particularly our insurance provider and also our home insurance provider and also our estate planning attorney and department, keep a list of all the firearms that we have. And I want to ensure that this would not impede the ability to keep those lists, not necessarily on our person or in our home, but in these financial institutions and in these insurance liabilities, so that if something did happen to our home, as we experienced a fire early on, we'd be able to recoup the costs.
Okay. For the record, Paul Menke, through the chair to Senator Tobin. I have an answer that may suffice, but if not, I'm happy to follow up with legislative legal and get a memo to hopefully clarify that. But I would like to direct the committee's attention to line 17 on page 4. So it says, this subsection does not apply to an owner of a privately owned firearm who keeps or causes to be kept a list, record, or registry of the owner's own firearms. Mm-hmm. So my assumption would be that when the private firearm owner contracts an estate attorney or an insurance company and voluntarily gives that information over, that would be the person causing to be kept a record of those firearms. So I believe that would not be a concern, but I can reach out to Legislative Legal and clarify that for you, Senator.
Follow-up? Thank you. That would be very helpful, as I particularly think about when those particular firearms are in the transfer process or probate process. There is no technical owner as they're going through a legal dynamic, and so you wouldn't want those to get lost in the milieu of what happens when, unfortunately, people pass away.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have it. What I think I hope is an easy one, but it's just sort of a mechanical question on your definition of ammunition. It lists all the component parts of ammunition. Does it need to list loaded rounds? Because they're not in there, and people often just buy a box of loaded ammo.
For the record, Paul Menke, through the chair to Vice Chair Keel. I am unsure of that. If this definition would not suffice already loaded ammunition, I would assume because it contains all those parts, but not it doesn't explicitly say loaded ammo. So I would have to clarify that for you, Senator.
Thanks.
Thank you.
One final question.
I won't hold you to one, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so my question really is around, and I'm looking at the section again on page 4, line 14, where it talks about criminal investigation and prosecution. And albeit I am married to a federal investigator, I don't actually know how investigations start. I'm assuming that they're not actually in the process of providing any sort of documentation or paperwork. They're looking at patterns of behavior. And from what I have been able to glean from the internet, that sometimes those merchant category codes are used to track whether someone is purchasing a large amount of rounds or firearms and planning potentially to do some very large-scale harm. And so I'm curious if you've talked to law enforcement about how this might impede their ability to actually track or understand if there is a terrible event being considered by an entity or a person.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, we haven't, but obviously that's a question we gladly ask.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So going back to page 2 in the Attorney General. I guess I was a little caught by surprise when the bill gives the Attorney General the power to investigate a violation of Alaska law. Pretty sure that's a general power of the Attorney General. Is there a reason that we want to put it here in Section C?
I think that's Section E.
Oh, E? Thank you. My notes went right over the letter.
All right. I had seen E, and I thought, wait a second.
Page 2, line 16. Is there a reason we need to put it there?
For the record, Paul Menke, to Vice Chair Keel. I am unsure, and I believe Nancy Mead from the Alaska court system is present in the room and might be able to answer that question or clarify that.
that sounds like a call for Ms. Mead, or is this Ms. Mead? We do see you in the room. You're a regular attendee at Judiciary Committee meetings. Is there anything on this topic in which you can provide any insight or observation or comments?
Thank you to the chair. For the record, Nancy Mead, general counsel for the Alaska court system. I was here to explain any questions about the court rule changes, but with respect to the question by Senator Vice Chair Keel, I understand your point that perhaps that does not need to be written in the statute. I guess I would defer to the drafters as to why they put that in there. You're correct. To my knowledge, the Attorney General can investigate any suspicion of a crime. It seems to flow from D to E that somebody kind of says to the Attorney General that they think there's a violation. I suppose E could just say if the Attorney General finds a violation without saying they may investigate, since that's assumed. But I would defer to the drafters as to why it says exactly that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much, Ms. Mead. Yeah, I was similarly sort of was going to follow up on the giving a person the ability to go to court if they believe they've been the victim of a violation of state law. And again, that's my general assumption, is that a person can go to court if they think a company or a financial services provider has broken state law and they are harmed.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, I would agree with that, that somebody can always sue the state for something they think the state did illegally or inappropriately. This does make it particularly explicit with this type of cause of action, and I don't know if the drafters think that's necessary or not.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we have you here, Ms. Mead, I was going to ask the sponsor, but I'm sure it's more appropriate to you. Can you would you be willing to lay out for me what the differences are from the existing court rules to the court rules as changed here?
Through the chair to Vice Chair Keel, sure. I am looking on page 4 at the section 3 has the two indirect court rule amendments. And what I see on lines 25 and 26 is an indirect change in Rule 65. Rule 65 is the civil rule having to do with injunctions. Usually when a party needs an injunction, a preliminary injunction in particular, there's some sort of emergency or some sort of urgency that requires a ruling right away to prevent somebody from doing something or forcing them to do something, enjoining them. And those go into effect as soon as the judge issues them, typically. That's what the rule is about. This bill, however, says, if you flip back to page 2, lines 28 through 30, subsection G says, so that if the court issues an injunction, it does not take effect for 30 days. So that's how this bill modifies the normal court rule on how injunctions work. The legislature may choose to do that. You just need the majority vote. That is your policy call if you want to make that indirect change to the rule. It's not something that we would change the court rule. It's just this odd situation doesn't follow the normal procedure. Similarly, if you look at subsection B on page 4.
Just for matter of clarity, if I'm suing today and seeking an injunction to say stop polluting, stop letting this pollutant get into the stream, that injunction typically would say stop immediately. And the difference here is this: if the injunction was granted, we'd essentially be giving the financial institution 30 days to fix it.
To the chair, yes, that is the modification to the rule, that it would not be immediate because the statute trumps the rule in that regard if it passes by the required vote. Okay, and then the second court rule change is to Rule 82, and I'm looking at page 4, lines 29 through 31. Rule 82 is our civil rule about attorney's fees. So typically, a losing party has to pay a portion of the winning party's attorney's fees, depending on where in the case, at what procedural stage of the case it ended. And there's a chart basically in Rule 82 about how much you can recover, what percentage of actual fees. However, this bill would change that in these causes of action, and that change appears on page 3, lines 6 to 7, new subsection I, which says the court shall award the attorney general or petitioner, whoever brought the suit, if they win, full reasonable attorney's fees. So that's unusual in law. Usually you just get a portion, but a statute can say that, and it would just have that indirect change to Rule 82.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you.
I'm getting it on both sides.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. We wanted to get you into the session in top fighting shape here. A question maybe to the sponsor. The way this is drafted, do the full reasonable attorney's fees run both ways? If a financial institution wins, do they get their full reasonable attorney's fees? Or is this a one-way full fee?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. It looks like it's a one-way thing, to be honest with you, but we can definitely make sure of that. But yes, the way I read it, it looks like it's one way.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
My initial thought would be if we're gonna do full attorney's fees, it probably ought to be, either everybody ought to bear their own risk and cost, or everybody ought to bear the loser pays risk, rather than it only going one direction. That seems a little out of balance to me.
And I'll follow up with that question for either Ms. Mead or Senator Cronk's staff. Can you give us an example of some of the other types of cases that specifically allow full attorney's fees as opposed to the standard scheduled attorney's fees? And the reason the question is sort of what makes this particular, I mean, not undermining the importance of firearms, but why, whatever that small group of matters in which we're allowing full attorney's fees, how does this fit within the rubric in the vast majority of cases where there are no full attorney's fees, but just a scheduled amount?
To the chair, I would have to do some research to respond to that question. It is not common in statute to provide for full, always reasonable, though, attorney's fees, and I could look that up.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Senator Tobin.
You got a little bit ahead just on that one.
Oh, no, thank you. As I often defer to the lawyer in the room, you will have more articulate questions than I may be able to ask. So my question to you, Ms. Mead, as well, is while you're doing that research, can you help us understand if incentivizing in one direction creates a circumstance where you might see folks use it as a I want to stay away from the word of like incentivizing action or incentivizing folks to make claims that they would not necessarily otherwise claim. Has this played out in other situations where you've seen the full reasonable attorney fees be provided? Does this create that dynamic?
Through the chair to the Senator Tobin, I understand the question. That would not be something that we would have data on, unfortunately. I don't know if I'll even be able to get anecdotes, but I will. I'll do my best. Thank you.
I don't see other questions. I had a couple of questions. As a background, I remember talking to a couple of folks involved in some tech industry features, and I said, so what really do they know from my credit card records, and how much information is really out there, and how much is out there sort of in the commercial world and what? And the general answer was, you don't really want to know because they have a whole bunch more information than you would be comfortable with, and it's not just about firearms. I mean, I sometimes, you know, I'm reading a magazine online and suddenly I see an ad pop up for yogurt. I'm thinking, why is it yogurt? But then the yogurt keeps showing up, and it must be because somewhere in all this information that they have on me, and they know either the websites I've looked for or the things I bought, they know I bought yogurt with some frequency. And I'm thinking, I don't really care whether I have yogurt or not, but there's a part of me that's thinking, am I really crazy about the notion that somebody out there knows I eat a lot of yogurt? And that doesn't make me so warm and cozy. And I guess that's one of the questions I wonder about. The privacy interests seem pretty important on more things than just firearms. And my sense is that there's a whole bunch of that stuff out there that I'm not crazy about it. And I think we have a great right to privacy in Alaska, but I'm not sure it's doing much about what they know about my credit card purchases. I'm not sure. I mean, that's kind of an abstract question, but why, if they're getting all this information about a bunch of other stuff that we buy, why should we be treating firearms differently than everything else.
Through the chair, I just believe there's, you know, for me, obviously, it's data that I feel could be really used against certain people and target them, you know, and obviously we have people that are pro-2A and there's lots of people that are not, and they don't care about your individual rights and stuff like that. And we're just trying to make sure people that are 2A are not specifically targeted out and any, you know, unfairly treated, or, you know, you could have many different things through it. You know, it's a hard question to ask because I totally understand what you're asking there, but I just, you know, the gun issue is a big issue. It's obviously important to many people, and I think that's the highlight of this bill, is to make sure that, you know, people don't get to share that information around, and they shouldn't know that information. I don't think the general public should know how many guns anybody owns. It's up to them, as long as they're keeping them, you know, keeping them at home and they're not harming people. That information could be used in many different ways if people knew that. Okay. Purpose of the bill.
Okay. And then the other query, which is follow up on the questions that Senator Keel, I think, was asking about the Attorney General, but a little bit different. I generally agree with his suggestion that the Attorney General has the authority to investigate whatever they want to investigate, and because it's a violation of state law. But I'm wondering, at some level, this is, by having all these specific provisions, including the full attorney's fees, it suggests that the Attorney General should have a higher duty to investigate violations of this particular law than other particular laws. And it's sort of at the top of my list with resource issues in all levels of state government. I'm quick to say they should be investigating the murders and the rapes and the crimes. And if that means they don't have the resources to necessarily pursue a financial institution, and I'm going to leave that to them, but one of my concerns is just specifically adding the Attorney General in this mix as opposed to private individuals who have the right to bring action. Does that start prioritizing how the Attorney General spends their time that might not be the priorities that some would have for where they spend time?
Yeah, go for it. Thank you. For the record, Paul Mankey, to the chair. I think I understand your question, and obviously we don't want this case deals with a lot of civil matters, so this would be an award in a civil-ish manner, although it would be investigated by the Attorney General, and I don't want to impugn my boss here, but I don't think that but I don't think we want the murders and the rapes and those types of serious crimes to take precedent. But when it comes to the civil matters, I believe that because this is dealing with not only Alaskans' constitutional rights to keep and bear arms, but also the constitutional rights for privacy, that this might have a higher case in terms of civil matters.
I don't see any other questions. There are a number of questions that you can get back to us. The other thing I would note, I don't see any comments at all from any of the banks or any of the credit card companies. Have you shared this bill with them? Are they okay with it? Do they have any concerns?
For the record, Paul Mankey, to Chair Klayman, yes, we have been in contact with a few. We've actually had quite a bit of contact with Yuri Morgan, the lobbyist on behalf of the Alaska Bankers, and I believe that they have some comments. I know they had some critiques or some concerns over the bill, but they also he did not finalize any sort of letter of support or opposition or neutrality to the bill. So if the committee would like, we can reach out to them to see if they would be willing to finalize one of those.
I encourage you to reach out, and we'll also try to reach out to them, because actually something that has impact on financial institutions, I would like to see either their support, their non-support, or their non-opposition, as the case may be.
And for the record, Paul, if I may, Chair Klayman, we have had a meeting with Scott Talbot on behalf of the Electronic Transaction Association. Their opinion was neutral on the bill from our meeting. There was no letter or formal thing that was sent to our office or was shared with us. But just from our understanding of the meeting, they did not want to have to apply unique merchant codes to several different industries, whether or not it's firearms. So they did not want to have to. For instance, if it was a healthcare provider, the example that was provided to us was they did not want to have to distinguish a pediatric doctor's from, let's say, an abortion clinic. That was the example given to us. But they said that this bill would not really affect that. It would just keep them from – it would provide statutory limits against them, like having to distinguish a small general firearm retailer from a sportsman's store. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tilton, welcome.
Thank you, Mr.
Questioning world.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I actually just have a comment, and just for transparency, I want you to know that I was the companion bill on the House side, carried that, and that also I would also like, for transparency, to let you know that Donna Anthony is a constituent of mine and also a very good friend, and I have heard of the incident that did happen with her, and it is an occurrence that is quite concerning.
Just,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did she finally get paid in the end?
She did.
Okay. That's good. All right. I don't see any other questions. Any final comments for Senator Cronk or your office before we set the bill aside?
Through the chair, I just want to thank you guys for hearing the bill, and we will address the great questions that you guys had and see if we can, you know, satisfy all the questions for everybody. But yeah, thank you for the time. Obviously, first committee meeting of the year. We got there. So thank you.
Yep. Well, thank you very much. We will hold the bill for further review at this time, and we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, January 28th at 1:30 p.m. Our next meeting on Monday, January 26th, is canceled. And with that, we stand adjourned. The time is now 2:06 p.m.